Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning.
We're going to be discussing today four very important cookbooks, and I have to start out by saying that in this downtime, economic downtime, I continue to be amazed by the raft of important big deal cookbooks that are published. And this one, the first one, is actually been 6 years in the making. It's by Amanda Hesser. It's a huge volume, and it's called The Essential New York Times Cookbook. I must say that I am totally impressed with this monumental book by Amanda Hesser called The Essential New York Times Cookbook, subtitled Classic Recipes for a New Century. And I think there's a message in that subtitle, too, which you're going to tell us about. But, Amanda, when we interviewed you about a previous book, you mentioned that you were working on this book, but you didn't present it as such a major project. I mean, I'm totally overwhelmed with this. You said that it took 6 years to do?
Yes, it did. I didn't plan for it to take 6 years, but I tested 1,400 recipes, not alone. I worked with a woman named Meryl Stubbs, and we cooked them together. And it just takes time to, like, actually do that much cooking, but also to really sort of comb through the archives. The New York Times archive goes back 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the exciting thing is that, you know, we've obviously, the Times has been writing more and more about food and covering it from every angle over the past decade and also previous decades, but the 19th century archive is incredibly bountiful and fascinating. Nobody really knows about it, and there are really some incredible recipes from there. So when I started the project, I was thinking that I was going to be kind of covering the 1960s forward, because in 1961, right, the New York Times published the Craig Claiborne New York Times cookbook, which was a big hit. But then I discovered that the Times had been writing about food for 100 years before that, and I just felt like it was imperative to include all 150 plus years in this book.
Well, what gave you the idea of this cookbook? How did it get started?
So it actually happened in a very kind of casual conversation over lunch. I was having lunch with a book editor at the New York Times, and we were talking about just basically about cookbooks in general. And we started talking about Craig Claiborne's New York Times cookbook, and it occurred to us that, wow, this huge best-selling cookbook was published in 1961, and so much had changed in the food world since then, and the Times had been, you know, at the forefront of covering all of those changes, and yet there was no book to kind of sum it all up and distill it into a book form. And so it just felt like it was time to do that.
I have that book. It's two volumes. Is that the one you're talking about?
It's a single volume, blue cover.
Oh,
there were other New York Times cookbooks that were since then, but there were none that were as comprehensive as that one. And the thing that's interesting about that book is people think of it as kind of like this cookbook that represents the whole sort of New York Times food archive, but in fact it really just captures the mid-1950s through 1961. And it's an amazing book, and it's a real gem, and some people assumed that I was just updating that book, but in fact I wasn't at all, because I didn't feel like it needed any updating. It really holds up well, and I didn't want to be sort of making any attempts to correct it, because I didn't think there was anything that needed to be corrected about it. I wanted to do an entirely different book, which really distilled that 150 years of recipe and food writing.
Well, and you have. I mean, your voice is so pronounced throughout this, and your sense of humor. I found myself laughing hysterically over some of your asides.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be too dry. I mean, Nora Ephron is a friend of mine. She, when I started this project, she said, you should write it from a personal point of view, because people want to feel like you're in the kitchen with them.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
so that's the way I approached it. And that's why I felt like I needed to cook every recipe. I needed to know that every recipe really belonged in there, and be able to kind of give people context and help guide them along, especially with recipes that were unfamiliar to them. Like a recipe like Huguenot Tort, which is this really delicious meringue dessert that involves pecans and apples. It's actually quite simple to put together, but if you've never made this kind of baked meringue cake, you might be nervous. And so I try to kind of help you along and let you know that everything's okay.
Now, this book contains a lot of recipes. It's impressive in more ways than one, including the fact that it could be used to make brick chicken, something you didn't suggest.
That's a great idea. Just cover it with aluminum foil, right? Just like they do with the bricks.
You did suggest the use of a doorstop was inappropriate, but maybe you were just worried the book would get wet if that's what happened.
Well, I did say you could use it to press tureens, so.
You did. Now, one of the amazing things is the breadth of coverage, because I notice that you draw the distinction between Welsh rarebit and Scottish woodcock, which to most people would be totally impossible to understand. What I never knew was there was such a thing as Yorkshire rarebit, that being the part of the country that I was born and raised in. So if you're looking for variations on a grilled cheese sandwich, there are lots and lots of variations in here.
Yeah, there are a lot of recipes that capture people's attention in different eras, but kind of repeatedly. So, like, gazpacho is something that, you know, kind of shows up in the 60s and then shows up again in the 90s and 2000s. And so I included different more than one recipe for them so that you could see how it evolved.
And you have, first of all, you outline ways to use this book and ways not to use this book. I loved your ways not to use this book. For academic research, or as a path to weight loss, and as a doorstop. But explain these time frame diagrams you have. I mean, just so that our listeners will know what they're like, because they're very important, and they really help give a sense of where we've been, and in a sense, like where we're going.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly why I included them. You know, I'd like to take a step back and just sort of explain how I've arranged the book, because it's a little unconventional.
Yes.
The conventional part is that I've arranged the chapters into classic cookbook categories, which are kind of the progression of a meal. Like you start with hors d'oeuvres and you work your way through salads and soups and on your way to dessert, right? Mm-hmm. But then within each chapter, I organize the recipes chronologically, which if you don't know right away, it's maybe a little confusing because you kind of go from like chicken to duck to quail to chicken recipe by recipe. But the reason I did that was so that you could see that, so that each chapter felt A, like an adventure, that you're kind of exploring your way through the decades, but also that there was a narrative there. You could see how we had changed and evolved and revisited things and then discovered new dishes and new ideas and iterated on them in different ways. And so to add additional context, in the beginning of each chapter, I give you a timeline that sort of gives you a sense of what has happened relevant to that. Like soups, for instance, you know, a really big advancement was the invention of the blender because you no longer had to push soups through a sieve. So I wanted to sort of tell you when the blender is invented.
Yeah, there are a number of things like that. I mean,
and when certain trends pass through and people, and, you know, for instance, like a cultural kind of emblem is the soup Nazi from Seinfeld. I mean, you know, it's not exactly a food reference, but it's, you know, it's something that everyone kind of knows. And, you know, that was, and it prompted this soup craze in cities around the country. And so I wanted to sort of also then to be kind of these fun timelines and not these kind of like dry academic things. So
they are fun.
The timelines, and then I organized the recipes into categories so that you can see what, you know, if you want a seasonal soup, like a winter soup, or, you know, a soup that can be served cold, or a soup that serves more than 8 people. So I wanted you to be able to navigate the book in lots of different ways and in ways that are really kind of relevant to the way, to how you'd want to use it.
But thank goodness it has a wonderful index, because otherwise you'd never find just the thing you're looking for.
Well, in the back, you know, I don't know if you noticed this, but there is this whole section on menus. And so,
yes,
you know, all the Thanksgiving dishes are there. You know, there's a menu for the Super Bowl. There's a Spanish menu. There's menus by era. So you can do like a 1970s dinner party. And, you know, and then every recipe in the book,
sort of like,
I give you.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of like what Alinea is doing, this period dinner stuff. I mean, not Alinea, but his next restaurant, what's it called? Next.
I have no idea.
I'm talking about Grant Ackerson doing this restaurant that's focusing on different periods.
Yeah.
Isn't it weird, huh? I just thought it was odd. But I guess that's what we do now. We're so advanced, huh? We go back and revisit periods.
Well, I think that the thing that became clear to me just in reviewing all of these decades-old recipes is that there are a lot of things that we think of as new that just aren't. For instance, braised short ribs is something that, like, you find that people are cooking at home like crazy, but there are recipes for braised short ribs in the 1940s. Things like olive oil, we think of, you know, olive oil as sort of being discovered by Americans in the 1980s, but in fact, lots of recipes in the 19th century call for olive oil, and there were great stories on how olive oil is produced back then. So there is a kind of fashion cycle to food, which is kind of great, and I think that we just, we tend to be enthusiasts about things, so we kind of latch onto an idea and then go crazy for it, and then move on to the next thing.
I think you've also got No, you say don't use it as a book to do research, but it does have some interesting things. And I happen to fall into possession of two large cuts of chuck roast, which I intended to cook in a particular dish when our son and family came here for the Christmas holidays, and then they decided not to come. So all of a sudden, with two meat eaters, but not very large meat eaters, I have 7 pounds of chuck roast. So I have to figure out what to do with it. Well, I solved half the problem by making chili yesterday, which we're going to eat for the first time tonight. But I was also looking for a daub. Is it a daub or a daub? A daub recipe. And I found myself. I found myself with a classic conflict between Anne Willen's country French cooking, who says essentially you put it all in a pot, marinate it with red wine for 12 to 24 hours, and away you go. And then you just cook it. And James Peterson's fine book about French cooking, who says one of the most annoying things to me, one of the things I was trying to avoid, which is you have to brown the meat first, which I always found to be a real chore. Now, you've got Brief Bourguignon 1 and Brief Bourguignon 2. Perhaps you can explain.
Yes, well, I just want to take one step back very quickly, which is that Julia Child's daub also is similar to Anne Willen's. I've made it many times, and I don't agree that you need to always brown the meat. Yes, you get a certain effect from doing that, but I think that it's also a delicious dish without doing it. I was also going to recommend another recipe in the book, which is a Dijon beef stew, which is kind of like a daub, and it's just fantastic. It's not that old. It's probably from, like, the late 80s or 90s. It's Dijon and cognac beef stew, and that's great. And I think I have to actually refresh my memory about which one of the, basically, the differences between the Beef Bourguignon 1 and Beef Bourguignon 2 are one of complexity. Like, one has more technique and more ingredients, and the other has less. I love them both. And I had friends who tasted them both, and they were kind of raved from both tastings, and so I just felt like, why not include both of them?
This is one of the things that I think makes the book just a lot of fun. So even if you're not intending to cook, you can sort of sit and have a little adventure about what you might be cooking if you could be bothered. At the same time, you're getting lots and lots of very interesting information. It might not be pure research information, but it's information with a wry sense of humor, which makes me laugh.
And there are little stories that she tells along with it, which puts it on a whole more personal plane, too. Amanda, we skipped over a part is when you solicited people's favorite recipes.
Yeah.
Tell me, how many responses did you get?
Oh, thousands. So I put an author's query in the paper asking people for, you know, the favorite recipes of all time. And the next day was met with this tidal wave of emails. And soon after that, letters. And people would send in their actual original tattered clippings from the Times. And they would hear these personal notes about what the recipes meant to them or how they tweaked them or even how they served them. And the amazing part was that people continued to send these me for 4 years. But after 4 years, they gave up, and they probably assumed I was never going to write this book. But, you know, people were just are so passionate and loyal to the Times, and, you know, people have been cooking recipes for decades. And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about their suggestions is that four of the top five recipes that were recommended were more than 20 years old. So people have been
cooking
with
them
more. There's David Ayres pancake, which is it's also known as a German pancake or a Dutch baby, and it's a skillet and oven baked pancake that's done in a cast iron skillet, and it's like this very thin batter. It's almost like a crepe, and it spreads across the base and up the sides and out of the pan, and it's very dramatic and beautiful. And it's kind of like a souffle, because it doesn't really hold up that long. You have to kind of rush it to the table, but it takes no effort at all. I mean, it literally involves whisking together about four ingredients and just pouring it into the pan, so anyone can do it, and it's really delicious and also really impressive, and it's the kind of thing you could do for a dinner party for dessert, or you could make for brunch. The purple plum tort, which is the most famous recipe in the Times, which Marion Burroughs wrote about. And
but isn't that surprising? Wasn't that surprising as a winner?
Oh, really? Oh, I wasn't surprised, because I just know so many people who make that recipe, and 265 people wrote in about that one recipe.
Wow.
And it was first published in 1983.
Well, if you need any more reasons to use this book, I just double-checked myself because I thought I remembered this. Not only do you have the single dishes, but you also have suggestions as to what to put on the same menu.
Because I wanted people to be able to kind of really explore their way through the book, and I wanted to help guide them. I sort of feel like I'm like the tour guide through this 150 years. Okay.
Wow. So listeners, you've got no excuse, especially not if you're building a new house. If you're building a new house, you can order several gross copies of the New York Times cookbook, and then you can build a house with a kitchen included. But seriously, Amanda, we're enjoying the book, and we get literally hundreds and hundreds of cookbooks to read, so if we're enjoying it, it must be good.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm so glad.
We haven't mentioned, there's so much we haven't mentioned because it's such a major undertaking, is that you also have the originators of the recipes, like Tom Colicchio Rose Levy Barenbaum and Julia Child and Mark Bittman and so forth and so on. But you've kind of clarified some of these recipes, have you not?
When you say clarify, what do you mean?
I mean, did you print them word for word?
No, well, I mean, I actually did, did quite a bit of work on all the recipes, especially the old ones, which I really had to write as modern recipes. But
well, this is what I was leading up to, is that, remember I said about the subheading, about how these are updated so that they are not, I don't know what words you use, but these are a contemporary attitude recipes.
Yes, exactly. I wanted every recipe in the book to be accessible to anyone who cooks. And so I did not change recipes to, use a different low-fat yogurt or whatever. I didn't sort of impose any kind of editorializing of the recipe. What I did was simply kind of unearth them and make them kind of clear and understandable so anybody could make them. And so, in the old, there was a lot of old recipe language where, they would say to make a stew in a kettle. Well, no one knows what a kettle is anymore, so I would just change the language so that I would, call for the equipment that, you and I are familiar with. But cooking notes, so that, if I found that, something needed more salt, or you might want to serve it with something else, I kind of, so that you would understand all the different options that you had.
How did you know so much? I mean, where did you get all this information?
I've been cooking for a long time. I've been writing about food essentially 1994 or 95. When you cook 1,400 recipes, you cook a fair amount.
I just can't even imagine doing that. Could I ask, we've already recommended the book, I ask you to explain your other project briefly before we conclude this? Because well, Amanda's one of my Twitter buddies, too, so I get a lot of Twittering going on about, it's called your website?
Food 52.
Food 52, and I've enjoyed following that, and your contretemps with, what's his name from the, what's his name? I forget his name now.
Oh, Crook.
That's one, So
Who is it? I still didn't figure out who it was.
It's Cooks Illustrated.
Cooks Illustrated. But
Chris Kimball.
Chris Kimball.
Kimball.
Right. And I guess we've interviewed him also. But anyhow, I mean, basically you're at conflict because you were doing a kind of a community contribution recipe.
Yeah.
Is that
it? So my friend Meryl and I, who did all the testing of the New York Times cookbook recipes, who I did them with, she and I had launched the site called Food 52, and it was really inspired by our work testing these New York Times recipes, which is that there's something special about a home cook's recipe that really speaks to other home cooks, and that was very clear given the recipes that New York Times readers suggested. And so we wanted to create this online platform that allowed the crowd to essentially still and curate the best recipes. And so what we do is every week we name recipe themes, and then anyone can send in a recipe relevant to that theme. We narrow it down as kind of the initial curators to two finalists, and then anyone can vote. And then the winning recipe goes into a cookbook that'll be out next year. And the whole idea is that you can go to, you have a place where the community is distilling and curating, now recipes, now we have questions and answers, and soon it will be other parts of other things related to food. But it was a way of kind of handing the reins over to regular people who now, know a ton about food, are incredibly passionate, and have things to say. And we wanted to give them a place to do that.
Well, certainly, you got the pulse of the contemporary cooking scene, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a success. How many hits do you have?
A lot. I mean, we have a fair amount. It's grown a lot in the past year, and I think that, you know, it wasn't the easiest concept to understand because nobody was sort of doing it, so it was a little bit new. And but I think that now that people are kind of understanding how it works and seeing the amazing quality of the recipes have been phenomenally good and impressive, and even the more people are sort of cooking and tweeting and Facebooking about them, I think that people are starting to see that this is a really trustworthy source and it's a community that's incredibly generous and creative.
Well, I can't wait. I guess we'll talk to you again when that book comes out.
And
lots of luck with this one, the Essential New York Times Cookbook, which is it's really going to take a place right there on my table in the kitchen where I keep the books that I use all the time.
Great.
So, Amanda, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and good luck.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We've been talking a lot about vegetarian cooking and gluten-free cooking recently, so we were startled and fascinated by a book that landed in our hands just a little bit ago, all about how to source, how to prepare, how to cook good old favorite meat. So here we are.
We have a new landmark book by a James Beard Award-winning writer, Deborah Krasner, and it's called Good Meat, The Complete Guide to Sourcing and Cooking Sustainable Meat, with more than 200 recipes. Welcome to On the Menu, Deborah. I love your book.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
It's truly a classic. I think you learn more from it than you ever thought you needed to know, actually.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, all these things.
That was left on the cutting room floor.
Now, you must have learned quite a lot along the way, too, I guess.
I did, and there was always a choice about how many disgusting facts do you put in about industrial systems and how heavy-handed are you with the health information. And in both of those instances, we decided to be subtle and allude to things rather than be too particular and hit you over the head with it.
Now, I asked you before we came on the air, were you inspired by a book of a similar name by a British farmer author? And you said yes.
Absolutely. I think the River Cottage Meat book is a wonderful book, and I think that the work that Fernsley Whittingsley is doing in England is wonderful. What I very much wanted to do was kind of have an American response to that book because, well, we're a much larger country, and our culinary traditions are extremely diverse, and I wanted somehow to address this whole question of meat from almost a housewife perspective, that is to say, as a home cook who cooks for her family and not as a restaurant-trained chef, and also as somebody who raises meat on a very small scale. And
in Vermont. And you,
in Vermont, very harsh climate.
Everybody we interview in Vermont, it turns out to be from Vermont, all the really great writers and artisanal producers and cheesemakers, they're all from Vermont.
Yeah, that's
it's in the water then, isn't it?
Everybody goes to Vermont because it's exactly that kind of thing. But I wanted to mention another reason why I think your book is important, and the distinction perhaps between Hugh's book and yours is that in this country there's a whole lot more meat.
Yes, that's certainly true.
There's a whole lot more meat on everybody's plates. There's a whole lot more meat in everybody's freezers. There's a whole lot more meat crosses the counter at the shops.
Absolutely, right.
And as such, your work is very important. But tell us what you set out to do, because this is more than just a cookbook with 200 recipes. This is an introduction to meat that you've created that I've not seen elsewhere.
Well, I wanted really to make it possible for people to understand that they didn't have to buy meat at the supermarket, that there were real alternatives that would do enormous good for their own health, for the health of their family, for the health of the landscape around them, and for the health of the planet. And that seemed extraordinary to me, that you could do so much good by doing such a small thing, which is buying meat directly from farmers.
And, you know, if you had put this book out 10 years ago, nobody would understand what you were saying.
That's right.
And a whole lot of people still don't.
Yes, that's also true.
A whole lot of people think that...
A lot more, though, do nowadays.
Well,
yeah.
More people take advantage of it, but they're the people who already know what meat consists of, and they may buy it at the supermarket or Whole Foods for convenience.
But I still think there's enormous confusion. I have people who I think should know the difference say to me, well, what's wrong with grass-fed green finished? Or people saying, well, okay, so can I buy grass-fed meat at, you know, the local retailers? And I have to say, no, you really need to go to your farmer's market, find some local producers, take samples of theirs, see what you like, and then order it by the quarter, half, or whole animal quantity if you want to pay a very reasonable price for it.
You know, I just judged recently a grass-fed beef contest, and the difference from one animal to the next, from one season to the next, is extraordinary.
It is, and, you know, it's like apples. There are different species. The land that they're grown on makes a difference. In, you know, just one farmer's market in Vermont, you can usually find two or three different meat producers who are selling grass-fed lamb or beef or pork, and you could taste those variations quite easily.
But you get really down to fundamentals, because you start with a bull.
Yes.
Or with a ram. or with a chicken.
Right, and all of those animals, with the exception of the pigs and the cows, are my own animals. That is, all of those pictures in the book were taken right here where I live with animals that I grew that are now in my freezer.
Well, I'll tell you, your sheep here are very handsome.
Aren't they adorable?
One of the things that I think is interesting about the book is you have so many gorgeous, adorable animals all throughout that it seems contrary to your idea of killing them, but you address that.
It's true, because it's a real learning curve to understand that the meat on your plate is actually meat that you've known by name or by personality, and it's not an easy curve. And it's taken, I mean, I think that we actually made the transition in the first year, but it's a dramatic change in your thinking.
Now, how do you organize this book? Let's talk about that.
Okay, well, my idea was, if I was going to encourage people to be buying animals directly from the farmer, frozen in quantity, that I needed to have a recipe for every part of every animal that you would normally find at retail. Because my feeling is that if you cause to have an animal sacrificed for your appetite, you have an obligation to eat every edible part of it. And so I wanted to show how you could eat nose to tail all of the animals that you could normally buy at a farmer's market and do it piece by piece. So if you look at the side bit of every chapter, in the beef chapter, it will go by, first everything starts with ground meat of that animal, and then it goes by primals and subprimals. So if you look at the chuck or the shoulder, you'll see all of the different cuts on the side perimeter of each page on the margins, so you'll see where you are. My idea was that you could close your eyes, dip into your freezer, pull out a piece of meat, see that it was labeled beef round stew, go to the beef section, go to the round section, look for a stew, and know exactly how to cook it.
And that's really wonderful. Now, I wish we had looked at this book more carefully when I went to the freezer the other day and plucked out a rabbit. And as it happens, we did have a recipe. We had talked a few weeks ago to somebody who wrote
Shauna Ahern. Shauna Ahern's recipe is quite good.
Yeah, I mean, uh-huh. this lady wrote a gluten-free cookbook, but there was something about the rabbit. There was something. Oh, do I have to go? Okay. We're going to hold for a second because Peter has to go to the door.
Okay.
I was so pleased that we already had a recipe for rabbit from the gluten-free girls cookbook,
Shauna Ahern,
which called for doing it with
leeks.
Very interesting. Well, leeks, yes. So that's not uncommon. The uncommon thing was balsamic vinegar, white wine and balsamic vinegar, and it really turned out very well. But at that time, either I didn't realize, or I was too lazy, I didn't realize you'd have 20 rabbit recipes in your cookbook, so we're going to have to buy at least 20 more rabbits.
Well, I have to tell you that two of my absolute favorites are in the cookbook, and one of them, they're both color rabbits. One of them is called Red Rabbit, and it has Pimenton de la Vera, that wonderful smoked paprika, and chorizo, and it's just wonderful. And the other is an heirloom recipe from a friend's Australian grandmother, and it's called Orange Rabbit Fricassee. And it's made with oranges, and it's just delicious.
Well, I like the one with the rabbit hearts and kidneys.
Yes.
Now, the other problem is getting your hands on rabbit hearts and kidneys.
I found that if I ordered 6 rabbits from my local rabbit dealer at the farmer's market and collected all of their offal as I cooked them and, you know, each time just put it in the same freezer bag, then at the end of the 6 rabbits, I had enough to make these other recipes.
Rabbit kidneys are pretty small.
Not to digress, but rabbits have either big kidneys or big livers. Which is it?
One
of those organs is large.
We
were in Tours. I remember the city in France. We were in a city called Tours, and we had been reading the Michelin Red Guide before we got there. So we knew that this particular restaurant had a recipe for pig's feet, stuff with rabbit livers and kidneys.
Ooh.
And somehow or other, without really intending to, we actually finished up at that restaurant. That's what I had for lunch. And it was out of this world. One of the best dishes I've ever tasted in my whole life.
Oh, my. Sounds wonderful.
Well, I want to say that all of your philosophy behind the information is really solid about sustainability here, but the recipes themselves are also very interesting. I mean, I'm looking at pig candy.
Pig candy is a big favorite.
Now, how did you come up with all these recipes? I mean, you said you're not a chef. Now, you're obviously lying just a little bit.
Well, no, I mean a chef in the sense of having gone to culinary school and learning how to cook for the public. That's not my training. I learned to cook from books. I started out as a cookbook reviewer, and as a cookbook reviewer, it was really my job to cook extremely carefully and faithfully from cookbook. And so I took on the task of cooking my way through cookbooks before I reviewed them. And that was my culinary education, because I really learned a tremendous amount once I stopped kind of just looking at the list and closing a book and improvising, but actually following recipes.
Well, I think you've done an absolutely fabulous job, and I'm trying to figure out how we can come by your house for dinner.
Now, you have diagrams of all the main cuts of the animals. You have photographs of the individual bits. Then you have step-by-step color photographs of, like, here's one breaking down a side of pork with a butcher.
Right. That's Adam Tiberio, who is a wonderful skilled meat cutter who is now in New York at the Chelsea Market at Dixon's Farm Stand.
Yeah, well, they're the new celebrities, the butchers. And we had one grass-fed beef thing. They had a whole afternoon seminar for just general people, and it was it $150 or $250 a person, and it sold out.
Yes. And watching somebody break down. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, to figure out how to break down a.
I mean, how many of these people actually go out and butcher them?
That's a good question. And I guess they just wanted to know what they looked like.
And to really understand it. Because for me, I went to one of those demonstrations. That's how I met Adam in the first place. And I was tremendously impressed by his skill. But I was also really interested to see that once you kind of take a primal cut off the half animal and you lay it out on a table, you can begin to see where the subprimals come in. That is, they all are divided along the lines of gristle or bone. And suddenly you can see where these things came from. It isn't kind of an arbitrary shape. It's really determined by the anatomy of the animal, and that's very interesting.
And now you have these little, I don't know what we call them here, sort of blurbs of information, unexpected, that are fascinating, like the economics of raising 2 backyard lambs.
I kind of call those my ADD things.
Okay.
Not that I'm ADD, but when you have a conversation with someone, you always think of these other little digressions that you want to include but that aren't part of the narrative flow. And I wanted the book to have that. So there are 2 kinds of running sidebars, and one of them we called farm text, and that's kind of personal experience of my growing these animals. And then the others are informational sidebars, like why you should heat the pan before you put the oil in.
Well, I just think, but did you deliberately pick the cutest animals you've ever seen? Because it makes you
actually, that was our photographer, Marcus Nielsen, who really loves animals and who somehow got them to be at their most adorable.
I'm so pleased to see that that suet is back, too.
Yes, and for me, you know, that was really an education. I learned about fat from a wonderful book by Jennifer McLachlan called Fat.
We have that, yeah. We interviewed her.
Right.
And then she had us get her other one called Bones. Have you seen that one? Yeah.
Yes, they're both
she's
wonderful.
Great. Yeah, she's
but
great.
In any case, you know, it was from Jennifer's book that I learned how to crumple suet and, you know, pick out the plasticky bits. And
well, you know, when I was first visiting Peter's family in England, there was a they wanted me to make a pie, and I mean, I was looking around for cans of Crisco.
what's the matter with you? what's wrong with good old lard?
Yeah. Same happened in Australia. I had no ingredient was familiar to me for doing that.
Well, Anne just pointed out that there's a beef tongue recipe in here. And
yes.
It just so happens that in our freezer right now we have one beef tongue.
We're going to get more.
I told her I wasn't going to cook it until I got at least another one because it takes such a long time to prepare. You can just do it just easy for two or three. And,
yes.
And we sure polished it off the last time we had beef tongue, but now
just like that rabbit went too fast too.
Two rabbits at a time. You inhaled that.
Well, you should try. There's a wonderful recipe for lamb's tongues in the book.
Yeah, we have a friend who's a, I don't know if you know Jamison Farms, lamb. Well, they're friends of ours. And, of course, the funny thing is Mario Batali wanted how many hundreds of lamb tongues per week?
for his special salad.
Talk about not understanding.
John had to decline. I don't know whether he actually explained. Mario, did you realize that one lamb, one tongue.
So we'll try to get some of those, and I'm going to try to test. I've never in my life been able to pull off sweetbreads that didn't end up tasting like swallowing rocks.
Oh, well, that's just a really classic sweetbread recipe. I mean, I don't take any credit for it. It's just the usual way of doing it. But, boy, it tastes wonderful.
Well, I have another question is, when you did this, I don't know the names of your previous cookbooks. What are
the Flavors of Olive Oil was the one.
Oh, that's one. Yeah, I remembered that one. What are you working on next? Because you're always working on something else.
Well, I'm thinking about continuing and deepening this because there were lots of things I didn't get to. I didn't get to goat, for example.
But you don't have goat. I love goat. It's so hard to get though, too.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are a number of animals that I would like to look at and do things with. And I also wanted to look at other methods of cooking besides cooking. That is to say, smoking and curing and drying.
Oh, right. That's hot
so I haven't done any of that yet.
Yeah, charcuterie is the big thing right now.
Well, we can hardly wait for the next time.
Love meeting you, Deborah. It's been a delight meeting you. You know, we're good friends with both the Jamisons and the Elysian Fields folks.
Uh-huh.
And totally different lamb products, really.
So shall we conclude?
Yes. So, Deborah, I really need to put Vermont on our travel schedule because we have made so many connections there, and it sounds like such a wonderful place. So,
it is a wonderful place, and I do hope you'll come.
Thank you. Hope to see you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now time for another commercial pause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Thanks for staying with us, and we're about to move on to another gargantuan book called The Food Substitutions Bible, and it's for all of you who want to know how to trade this for that, swap in this for that. Just listen. How many items does this man do?
6,500. It's amazing.
How many times do you set off to cook a dish, and you haven't really checked the ingredients that well, or you're too far to run out to the store and get whatever? Well, David Jelkum has this totally resolved. It's called The Food Substitutions Bible, and it's the second edition. David, you've added a whole lot since the first edition of this book.
I did. I added 1,500 more substitutions, and the book already had 5,000, so now it's a total of 6,500 substitutions, all organized from A to Z, and that was really the criteria for the entire book, was to make it easy for people to find whatever substitute they're looking for.
Well, I got a little depressed, to tell you the truth, reading this, because I thought, after all these years being in the food business and eating for a living, I should know half of these ingredients, and I don't. What is this? Coupe-voissu. What is that?
Coupe-voissu. I'm not sure if you're pronouncing that correctly.
I'm not. It's C-U-P-U-A-C-U.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a fruit. It's a Brazilian fruit, and this is a very unique fruit, and it's unlikely that you would need to replace this.
What would I use it for to start with?
Well, it's got a lot of melon aromas, tropical fruit aromas. It's something that is often used for juice, much like acai juice.
Uh-huh.
It's juiced.
It says the fruit weighs 3 pounds.
Yeah, it's typically juiced. And you could use another tropical juice like acai, or you could use a red juice like pomegranate juice. And this is one of those juices that, it's one of those fruits that's juiced because of its healing properties, much like acai.
Okay, all right.
Well, that's one of just many, many, many ingredients that I didn't understand at all.
Well, out of 6,500, you could be forgiven for not knowing all of them, but you did ask me about vadouvin. Now, that sounds like an interesting story in its own right.
Yeah, vadouvin is not so much an ingredient as a preparation. And it's used in Indian cooking to provide a backbone of flavor. And the core of it is onions, but it's got just a haunting curry aroma in the onions. And it's because of all of the spices, as you would expect in any Indian dish, that go into it. And it's essentially onions and garlic with this seasoned mixture, and it's dried. It's oven dried. And then it's often sprinkled on the top.
Now you call that a spice rather than an ingredient, but they're all sort of mixed in together, right?
Yes, I mean it's sort of like pesto. Pesto is now considered an ingredient, but there's actually a few ingredients within it.
And you know, you must have an amazing store of knowledge to produce this book. I'm just overwhelmed by it.
Well, people ask me, how long did it take you to write this? And my answer is typically a lifetime. When I started writing the first edition in 2003, I had already culled many, many substitutions that I used, and I consulted with colleagues of mine, food writer friends. I would ask them, what do you use to replace something like vadouvin? It's a good question, actually. I talked with my friend Raghavan Iyer. He's an Indian cookbook author, and
I asked him
about that.
He's a very good Indian cookbook author.
Yeah, so in the second edition, I included a lot of ingredients like that from other countries because so much is changing rapidly in the culinary world now, and you can get ingredients more easily from around the world. Chefs are experimenting with ingredients that were once hard to find, and recipes call for ingredients that are sometimes hard to find, which is why I include substitutes for them. But this process of developing all of these substitutes was something that I started doing well before I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I write things down because I'm a writer, and I write down. I had a file of substitutes, and I basically built on the file. And the second edition includes substitutes that just wouldn't fit in the first because there were too many. I had to cut about 300 substitutes from the first book, so I put those into the second edition, and then another 1,200.
Now, you've also got a special section on the end that's invaluable stuff, too, like measure equivalents, and if I can't get this kind of bean, what would I use in its place? So
that runs all the way through, though. I mean, yeah, maybe what we should do is have him explain how this is organized. It's A to Z listing.
Well, the first part's alphabetical, but then you called some things out in the back.
That's right, yeah. And this was a decision on my part. Some ingredients have many different varieties, for apples, for instance, and you can replace any number of varieties with a single variety. There are many substitutes for a Braeburn apple, for instance, or a Gala apple. that will work well in a recipe. Let's say you're making some kind of an apple salad. There are many varieties of apples that will work. So I didn't want to put those in the main entry for apples because it's redundant.
I see.
So for that sort of ingredient, I included in the book a whole section of charts that show each ingredient and its varieties and the differences among the varieties. Chili peppers are a good example. There are hundreds of varieties of chili peppers.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't have all of them in the book, but a very good representative sample of chilies that you would find, including the hottest chili in the world, the Boot Jolokia or the Naga pepper.
Now, you did the same thing with beans. And it's really funny, it doesn't matter, you never seem to have just the right bean. Like if I want to use black beans somehow or other, I don't seem to have any. So you say, well, in this case, use that kind or this other kind.
Exactly, yes. So in that chart, I do have many varieties of dried beans and then about 5 or 6 possible substitutes for each variety, given the color and the size and the shape. And depending on what you're making, you could use substitutes that aren't even listed there. If you're making a black bean soup, you can use almost any kind of dried bean for a soup.
But, you know, you and I differ in certain ways here. Number one, I really am a firm believer there are certain things that you just do not have a substitute for. And I'm looking at one, cardoon. You say you can substitute chopped artichoke hearts. That's probably the closest. Chopped celery, I don't think. Is this a chopped salsa fee? I don't think that's the same thing.
Right. Look at it. We're going to get into an argument now.
If you're going to deal with cardoon, that's what you have to have.
I think you're exactly right. I completely agree. And in the introduction to the book, I say as much. I say if you really want the flavor of the original, of the ingredient or piece of equipment or technique that you're trying to replace, if you really want the exact results of the original, don't substitute. Every substitute is going to be different. Even if it's in a microscopically small way, it's going to be different. For instance, you can replace store-bought self-rising flour with flour and baking powder and cream of tartar at home. I mean, you can do that very easily. But it'll be very similar and almost exactly the same, but just microscopically different. It won't change the recipe enough that let's say it's a cake or a pancake or something like that. It's not going to fail. But the results will be slightly different.
Yeah.
Every single ingredient is different.
Here's one, head cheese.
Well, I think cardoons is a great example, actually, because because there are two distinct things about cardoons, and that's the shape of it and the flavor of it. The shape of it, you can replace a cardoon with celery if you're looking for something to replace the look of a cardoon.
Mm-hmm. Got it, yes.
If you want the flavor of a cardoon, celery is not even going to be close. But artichoke hearts will be close.
Closer, because they're relatives, actually.
Right. So in the book, I try to include notes with the substitutes to indicate what the difference will be, what will happen to the recipe, and if there are any adjustments necessary, what adjustments to make when you use the substitute.
Now, tell us a little bit more about, I know you've been on our program before, but for new listeners, what is your background exactly, David?
Well, I am not a trained cook. I'll just tell you that. I did not go to culinary school, but my training occurred in restaurants. So I guess you could say I'm a trained cook, but I didn't go to culinary school. That's often the first question.
Well, that's not necessarily the only way to be trained.
It's true. But nowadays, so many people go to culinary school that that seems to be the first question. And often from chefs, I hear that students coming out of culinary schools don't know how to cook.
I always hear that.
Yeah.
And they always think that they can.
Right. Well, I started out my first job, very typically of chefs and cooks, was as a dishwasher in a restaurant. I was underage. I was illegally employed, age 13, as a dishwasher. And I just worked my way up from there and started cooking. When it came time to go to college, I decided against culinary school because I'd always been in a band, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to do both of those jobs on weekend nights because they're both weekend night jobs. And I'd also seen some of my friends who were either in culinary school or working in restaurants, and it seemed like a very hard life. And I knew that it was a hard life, but that it would get even harder. So I decided to be a teacher instead, and I went to school, earned a master's degree in English, and my intent was to teach college English for the rest of my life. But after teaching college English for 3 years, I decided that wasn't really for me, and I missed food. I really missed food, so I went back to it through food writing. And this was when food writing was really blossoming as a profession in the late 80s and early 90s. So I went on staff at a food magazine after writing some articles. Was on
what
staff
one
at,
was that?
It was a vegetarian gourmet magazine.
Oh, okay.
A vegetarian magazine. And I edited a couple of cookbooks there, and I've always loved books and just devoted myself to cookbooks from there on out.
Now, this vegetarian thing, what's your take on that? Every time I talk to somebody, I mean, like, butchers are vegetarians.
Yeah, that seems like a contradiction, huh? Well, I think that eating less meat is probably a good idea for many people, depending on what your current diet is. And I think it's highly arguable that it's better for the planet to raise less meat, at least less than is currently being raised. But should you eliminate it completely from your diet? I don't believe that that's necessary.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like Mark Bittman, we just interviewed him about his new cookbook, and his doctor wanted him to go vegetarian, but his solution is he's vegan all day long and then a normal dinner, but with reduced quantities.
So just to show you that On the Menu is right on trend,
yes.
We had beef liver cooked in bacon fat at lunchtime. And for dinner tonight, hold on a minute. For dinner tonight, we're having a substitute for corned beef and cabbage.
Called
leftover corned beef and cabbage.
That's terrific. Well, I mean, I don't think that reducing or eliminating meat is for everybody. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. I was vegetarian for a number of years, and I found that I just couldn't get enough protein.
Right.
And I honestly feel much better when I eat more protein. And I don't eat excessive amounts of protein. I think I eat an average amount. But without that, I always felt a little run down and unfocused.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure that's right. I feel that way. I think Anne feels that way as well. So, but each chacun a son goût, as they say.
Yeah.
And next time, David, I'm sure you'll have another wonderful book for us the next time. I think we heard something about maybe some charcuterie or salumi in our future. So we'll expect to talk to you about a year from now, if not sooner.
Rustic cooking with one of our favorite chefs, yes. Okay, David Yoakum, ciao.
Ciao.
And a break one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And last but not least, perhaps the most remarkable effort of all the four cookbooks we're talking about, relevant not just to the particular community of the Jews, a book for everybody. It's a history book. It's a recipe book. It's a book that has a fantastic amount of information in it. And
I can't believe he actually couldn't use some. He'd have cut it down. Well, to the size that was thigh numbing, as I call it.
Yeah, it's another thigh number. All of them fit into that category, really, in today's program, but you need your thighs numbed every once in a while anyway.
Gil Marks is a chef, rabbi, writer, historian, and expert on Jewish cooking. His books have won awards, James Beard Award, IACP Award, and he's turned out a really remarkable most recent book called The Encyclopedia of Jewish Food. Welcome to On the Menu, Gil.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
How did it come about? You told us in a nutshell before we came on the air how you got started on this project.
Well, my editor at Wiley and Sons and I were talking about the follow-up to my previous book, All the Trees and Honey, and she basically said, look, you're a walking encyclopedia of food, so why don't you do an encyclopedia of Jewish food? And 3 years later, after researching and checking everything out, tried to create the most comprehensive, accurate, and readable collection as possible, and the result is the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food.
Now, you mentioned an interesting Yiddish word, I guess, before we came on the air. You said you had a major issue in that a lot of the information that everybody thought they knew about Jewish food was wrong.
Well, our food in general, there's a lot of misnomers, which we call Bubba Mises in Yiddish, which is old wives' tale. And so much, I hear it when I watch many of these food programs, they repeat these things over and over again. Everything from, like, the ice cream cone coming from the St. Louis World's Fair, when there was actually a patent for an ice cream cone about 20 years before that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of misnomers out there, and I set out to see as close as I could to make it accurate. For another example is cinnamon. The modern word cinnamon comes from the biblical word kinnaman, but the modern spice is not the same thing as the biblical spice. They're two separate items. The modern cinnamon comes from Sri Lanka and doesn't appear in the Western world until well after the medieval period, at which point the biblical kinnaman, the cinnamon, had disappeared, and probably some person, marketing ploy of the Middle Ages, said, well, we have this new spice, we'll give this biblical name to it, and voila, people think that they're the same, but historically they're different items.
Now, one of the things that makes this, I guess, a Jewish food remarkable is the centuries of tradition that lie behind it. And you have numerous examples of that.
Yeah, but it's not a homogenous. I think what's extraordinary is it's not a homogenous history. I mean, it really depends on different cultural
pockets. But the basics go back to the Hebrews wandering the desert and being in captivity and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that, I think, is celebrated in some of the basics of this food. Am I not right there?
Right. Well, to your point is that there is no one Jewish food.
Exactly.
There's a mosaic of Jewish communities that grew up across the globe.
Right.
Many of them dating back 2,500 or more years. The Iraqi Jewish community dates back to the diaspora to Babylonia by Nebuchadnezzar 2,500 years ago. The Persian Jewish community, all these were ancient communities, and each one developed their own culture and form of cuisine. And together, all of them, they tell the story of the Jewish people for the past several millennia, and it also reflects world history because they're intertwined.
Exactly.
And one of the major roles of Jews in cuisine is not so much innovation, but transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So they would take a dish or an item from one area and then introduce it, often with the Jewish touch, to it to a different area. So, for example, during the medieval period, what often happens is that culinary influences would come out of the Muslim world into Italy, and then from Italy would travel to the rest of Europe. So you would find, like, honey cake appearing in Italy around 1200 or so, and then several years later, they would show honey cake would show up in an Italian Jewish source, and about 100 years after that, it would show up in a German Jewish source, which would be about 100 years before it would appear in a non-Jewish German source. So there's this movement, and you'll see it over and over again. In the modern world, you'll find that with stuff like hummus and pizza and falafel, which are not Jewish foods per se, they're Middle Eastern foods. But Jews popularized them in America and the West so that they had their earliest mention of all three dishes was in a Pittsburgh Jewish paper. And,
really?
And then they, Chronicle.
Oh, the Jewish Chronicle. It's still running, yes.
It's in the encyclopedia. You'll find it there.
Okay.
and this appears over and over again, and then there's interesting quirks that were, for example, chocolate and vanilla, which come from Central America. The Indians were not particularly fond of the Spanish or Portuguese, so they refused to share certain secrets in how to prepare these foods. But for some reason, some of the Sephardic Jews who were in those areas, they liked them and they shared the secrets. So for the first 200 years, the Sephardic Jews had a monopoly on chocolate and vanilla coming out of Central America, and it was only after the Dutch and the English and French began planting cocoa beans in their colonies and learned the secrets that it spread wider. So there's all kind of interesting things, but the primary role is in this transmission that's repeated over and over again, and you'll see it throughout the book.
How did you learn all this? I mean, it's like, now, are you really trained as a chef?
Actually, I'm totally self-taught as a chef. I've never taken a cooking class in my life, though I give them all the time. I have my master's in community social work and history. And I just love food. I love eating food. I love the chemistry of food. I love cooking food. And I love the history of food and the cultural significance of the food. So these are all my passions. And somehow I just put them all together and try to create these cookbooks this is my fifth one. And this is a sort of the opus of them, that it's the culmination of all this information I've collected over the many years I've been studying and searching.
Which is astonishing.
How did you expect that readers would use this book? Is it a shelf reference book? Is it a cookbook? Is it more than that? Is it different than that?
The answer is yes to all of that. We want it to be a practical cookbook. And it is. There's about 300 or so recipes in here. Usually we include a recipe to illuminate particularly entry. So if I talk about chamin, the Sephardic Sabbath stew, most people might not know what it is. And so part of understanding what this dish is the recipe attached to it. So we include those. Unfortunately, I had so many more recipes, I could have done a second book just on those.
Maybe someday.
I will. But in the meantime, so it is a practical cookbook. There is recipes from Jewish communities all over the world. And yet at the same time, I want it to be a research volume. I wanted it to be something that I have a lot of people just told me that they just pick it up and like read it from item to item.
Well, that's kind of you just sort of, and then you get caught up in one. And, and then you can't get on to the next one, and you have to do it all again. But you did mention that it's arranged A to Z as a compendium, right?
Yes.
And you have, I'm astounded. You have here on the back cover, Did You Know? And some of the most amazing things, that matzah was originally soft and relatively thick. The pilgrims learned how to make baked beans from the Sephardim in Holland. European citrus production developed from the a Jewish need to cultivate citrus for Sukkot. Is it Sukkot?
Sukkot, yes. Sukkot holiday.
I'm trying to remember why we had citrus with that. But anyhow, potato latkes only became a prominent Jewish food around 1850 and derived from Italian cheese pancakes. This stuff is amazing, and the whole book's filled with things like that.
Right. Well, those are things I love, those gems and the information, and that I hope to share in this is this very interesting story, because basically each entry tells a little story or a bigger one, and then together it's a narrative of the Jewish people for 2,500 years, because nothing touches an individual and community's life more than food, both every day and period of celebrations. So to know a community is to know their food.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. And it's just amazing. I guess I did some research on, I had to write an article on Islamic holiday and breaking the fast. And I talked to all these people. Everyone had, there was only one thing in common with the whole Muslim world on this, and that was dates.
they eat, yes, and it's refreshing and stuff. But again, the Jews in the Muslim world picked up many of these foods too. Now, the difference is that the encyclopedia is not just foods that Jews eat, because more Jews today eat sushi and salsa than they do schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat, or schliskus, which are potato dumplings, Hungarian potato dumplings. So it's not just foods that Jews eat, it's almost foods that have been sanctified by their usage within some cultural or religious usage within the Jewish community. To quote Fiddler on the Roof, it's tradition.
Yeah, but I can just see some of my friends' mothers, Jewish mothers, recoil with some of the variations on their standard food.
Yeah, well, that's not only does each community have their dishes, but each household might have little variations
right.
to it.
Well, it's like that in Italian. It's like that in a lot of of cultures,
and
I guess.
Eliza, unfortunately, I couldn't put in the variations in this book like I usually do, but you can get some of the other books for more of the variations and stuff. But this one, as I said, it's a very complete volume within itself, and it just makes a wonderful gift for Hanukkah or a wedding, or any other time.
And I think this is absolutely a perfect gift. I was thinking Hanukkah, but you're right, for a wedding, some young bride.
I think every Jewish household should want to have this information at hand because, again, it's the story of the Jewish people. We talk about the holidays and the food traditions of the holidays and how they get started sometimes and the history of them. And some dishes you can trace back for more than 2,000 years and see them move through history. So you have this ancient dish called vermiculus. And it's found in Apicius, a 4th century Roman cookbook author, which is fried strips of dough in honey. And vermiculus means little worms. And it's also the name is also the source of vermicelli. So when pasta arrives in Italy, it's about the same time that the old fry dish disappears and the boiled dish of dough appears. But it travels to the Western Ashkenazi communities and becomes vermiculus. So in the year 1500, the predominant Friday night appetizer amongst the Jews in France and Germany were fried strips of dough and honey called vermiculus. Now, when pasta shows up there, it gets separated, and it becomes frimsel, is the Western Yiddish word for noodles from the same source, and gremzel, also from the same source, becomes fritters and fried doughs. And when it reaches Eastern Europe, it becomes kremzlach.
Right.
And today, many Jews still, for Passover, make little matzah meal pancakes and honey called kremzlach. So the word and the dish derives directly over 2,000 years from this ancient vermiculus.
Hold on a minute, Gil. If we give away too many more secrets, people are not going to buy your book.
There's over 650 entries and nearly 700 pages, so we're just on the tip of the iceberg.
Well, if I were you, I would be looking forward to next May, because I think you've got yourself another beard winner here.
And, oh, thank you. And, I appreciate your compliments.
And call us when we get to the encyclopedia part two.
Oh. Yeah, there are some things I didn't put in certain items, but basically it's as I said, as comprehensive as I could make it.
Thank you so much for your contribution to the world of food history. I think it's a significant contribution, and we should all be grateful.
Thank you. Oh, and I would just add on one more thing, is that I do find with this book is a lot of non-Jews just love it too, because they just love this food information and food history as well.
Oh, sure. I mean, I can just think of a million people to give this to.
Well, there's two of them right here, by the way, just in case you were wondering.
But I love it.
So. Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Gil. And as I said, keep in touch with us with your next project.
Oh, sure.
I'll see you in New York in May.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Well, that's all, folks, for another week from On the Menu Radio. We hope we'll hear from you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.